Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
A Republican senator is in his office, thinking about material he's just seen regarding the sitting president from his own party. And he's troubled because the evidence indicates a clear violation of U.S. law and an abuse of presidential power. The problem is, the rest of his party is staunchly behind the president. They're dismissive of the charges against him, and they're lambasting the Democrats as partisan hacks on a witch hunt. This Republican senator fears that he will be ostracized by his party if he comes out in favor of impeaching the president. Yet he's more troubled by whether he'll be able to face the judgment of future generations if he doesn't hold the president accountable for his behavior. Now, naturally, buzzkillers, you think I'm talking about Mitt Romney, the current junior senator from Utah and a serious and respected leader in the pre-Trump Republican Party. Romney's solemn reaction to the report of the July 2019 phone call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine, in which Trump, you know, appears to pressure the Ukrainian president to investigate Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden in return for official American funding for Ukraine's military. That reaction seems to indicate a senator putting American law and constitutional rights and wrongs above loyalty to party. But I'm not talking about Mitt Romney. I'm talking about Edward Brooke, the Republican senator from Massachusetts in 1973, who is thinking about the evidence slowly piling up about President Nixon and the Watergate scandal. Brooke became the first Republican to call for Nixon's resignation and more or less started what's often referred to as the bipartisan examination of the Watergate scandal in 1973 and 1974. Over and over again during this Trump impeachment, we hear from media talking heads and the chattering classes that, quote, the real heroes of Watergate were those Republicans who put country over party and convinced Nixon to resign, end quote. Heroes like Senator Brooke, Senator Howard Baker, and Senator Barry Goldwater. It was a more sober and sensible time of bipartisanship and a trust in basic civics and American government. Well, buzzkillers, not really. You see, it's kind of a myth that Republicans broke ranks with Nixon and brought bipartisan pressure on the president to do the right thing, that is to resign and let the country begin to heal politically. Almost all of what we're seeing during this Trump impeachment crisis, that is calling it a witch hunt, extreme partisan language, denigrating high-level civil servants, denigrating whistleblowers, denigrating Justice Department officials, and blaming the media, all of that happened during the Nixon impeachment years. Senator Brooke was the exception, at the very least, in timing. Republicans in the Senate and the House of Representatives only came to the conclusion that President Nixon was guilty and should be impeached very, very late in the process. In fact, only at the last minute. As is so often the case, careful attention to chronology helps us strip away myths and misconceptions and, as we'll eventually find out in this episode, the mistaken impressions given to us by the, you know, compressed sound bites of political history that seem to be all we get nowadays. Details matter. Fortunately, the details of how Watergate and the Nixon impeachment crisis happened are not dry as dust and only of interest to political scientists. They're thrilling in their own way. And they teach us a lot about how Washington worked and how it still works. So here's what happened. On June 17th, 1972, political operatives working, as we later found out, for President Nixon's re-election campaign broke into the offices of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate office and apartment complex in Washington, D.C. They were caught snooping around and burgling the Democratic offices. And they went on trial in January 1973 and were found guilty, but not before a few of them confessed to being involved with the committee to reelect the president. And a scandal started brewing. The U.S. Senate then set up in February 73 an investigative committee to look into what was already being called the Watergate matter. Now, this is one of those crucial differences between the Trump impeachment story and the Nixon impeachment story. In early 1973, the Senate started the investigations. Now, they were quickly joined by the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives, but both houses of Congress were involved more or less from the beginning, and both started hearings that would last over a year. Okay. Been talking for a while about this without mentioning much about Nixon himself or the state of the Nixon presidency in 72-73. To put it succinctly, Nixon was hugely popular after his landslide reelection in November 1972. He'd carried 49 states in the Electoral College and roughly 61% of the popular vote. And according to 538.com, one of the very best political stats operations around these days, Nixon had a roughly 60% approval rating at the start of his second term. That is January 1973. These are big, big numbers. And I think it's fair to say that the Watergate break-in and the initial news as it came out was not very scandalous, at least in terms of public reaction and public opinion. It was an odd story, and most people seem to regard it as a strange event that didn't make much sense. Why would Nixon bother trying to skew the 1972 election when it was obvious he was going to win big? So, congressional and public support for Nixon was strong in early 73, as the Senate and House committees started looking into Watergate and started calling witnesses to testify. Republican representatives and senators were solidly behind their president. House Republican leader, Representative Gerald Ford from Michigan, who would eventually become Nixon's vice president after Spiro Agnew resigned in October 1973. By the way, long story for another time, Buzzkill, as well. Gerald Ford called the investigation a, quote, political witch hunt, a sentiment that was echoed by Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens a little later, Republican senator from Alaska. Kansas Senator Robert Dole said that Watergate was simply Democrats throwing out, quote, a barrage of unfounded and unsubstantiated allegations, end quote, aided by their, quote, partner in mudslinging the Washington Post, end quote. And Edward Gurney, Republican senator from Florida, said that the Watergate scandal was, quote, one of those political wingdings that happen every year. In fact, Republican support was strong enough that Howard Baker, a Republican senator from Tennessee, started meeting secretly with President Nixon in late winter / early spring of 1973 to discuss Republican strategies for handling these investigations. If you don't know Baker and Watergate already, remember this name, Buzzkillers. He was careful to keep these meetings out of the press, of course, but his staff leaked Senate Investigative Committee information to the White House for much of the year 1973. Evidence about White House involvement in a Watergate cover-up started to come out in the early summer of 73 as witnesses to the Senate investigation disclosed details about Nixon's knowledge of the break-in. Even so, Republicans were still staunchly behind the president. The existence of White House tapes first became known in July 1973, but Congressman Gerald Ford again argued that taping White House conversations was part of executive privilege, and Republican Senator John Tower of Texas called the Watergate investigations into the tapes, quote, hysteria, unquote. But the evidence kept mounting. And it was then, on July 28th, 1973, that Senator Howard Baker, who, as I said earlier, firmly believed the president was innocent and was, in fact, helping Nixon on the White House's response to the Watergate investigations, asked the statement, what did the president know and when did he know it? Now, this is such an iconic statement and question in Watergate history, modern American history. I want you to hear the original clip. Here it is.
The central question at this point is simply put, what did the president know and when did he know it?
Okay, I'm going to let that Howard Baker quote hang there for a minute, Buzzkillers, while we take this break. And I'm taking a break early in this show because I'm so totally stoked that I can't wait any longer. We have a new sponsor, The Great Courses Plus, that fantastic online learning system where you watch documentaries, you watch real experts talk about all sorts of fascinating subjects from the best possible perspectives. They're the best researchers, the best minds applied to these questions, and you learn just sort of by osmosis by watching it. And the important thing is for this relationship with this episode is we're in the midst of this impeachment, but it's not the first time in U.S. history, of course. And Lady Buzzkill asked me all the time, well, you know, you had the Nixon impeachment crisis, we have this Trump impeachment, the Clinton thing. What about that Andrew Johnson fellow back in the 19th century? Didn't he get impeached? What was that all about? Well, we don't have to put on an Andrew Johnson impeachment show, Buzzkillers, because The Great Courses Plus has already done it. They've done it much better than we could ever do it. They've got Going to the Devil, the impeachment of 1868, a premier narrative documentary on the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson. Shows all the fascinating events leading up to and through the impeachment of Johnson, includes stuff about Johnson being Lincoln's vice president for a while, includes things like the Tenure of Office Act, which sounds really dry and boring, but is actually extremely fascinating. And all the tensions and all the anger and all the frustration about the Civil War and the end of the Civil War and Lincoln's assassination all seem to come together in this impeachment. It unfolds like a thriller. Backstabbing, acts of violence, twists and turns, cults of personality. You get to hear wonderful historical characters voiced like Thaddeus Stevens, like Charles Sumner. Going to the Devil is just one of the many fact-based videos available to watch or listen on The Great Courses Plus. It's the fabulous educational streaming service that you've been waiting for. You explore topics across a wide variety of categories. And as I've said a million times about all of our sponsors, we only get the best. These are the best professors and the best experts. Learning has never been so easy and so accessible. So, what have I been able to arrange for you? Well, listen to this. Special offer for my listeners, a full month of unlimited access to The Great Courses Plus for free. For free. A full month. Who knows how many courses you could go through in a month if you were diligent. And I would respect you immensely if you did. But listen to me. This isn't like most podcast offers. This isn't free shipping or this isn't 10% off your first order. This is free. Free. Lots of history courses, lots of science courses, lots of courses about literature and the arts and humanities that are absolutely essential to get by in this modern world. You'll absolutely love it. Here's how to do it. Sign up today by using our special URL, special website, and take advantage of this free limited offer. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. TheGreatCoursesPlus, spell it all out, .com/buzzkill. Log on, create your free account, and get not only the Going to the Devil impeachment show, but all the other ones as well. Do it now, Buzzkillers. GreatCoursesPlus.com/buzzkill. Now back to Nixon and impeachment. Okay, I think it's fair and accurate to say that Baker's "What did the president know?" question has been portrayed in subsequent years as an indication that Republicans like Baker suspected Nixon of complicity in the Watergate break-in and cover-up and were trying to nail down when the president became guilty. History documentaries and news channel summaries of the Watergate crisis show Baker asking this question. Then they cut quickly to White House counsel John Dean's famous, quote, "there's a cancer on the presidency" statement. And then they show Nixon's resignation speech as if they all happened one right after the other. But that's not the case. And the standard compression of these events gives us entirely the wrong idea about the Republicans in Watergate. In the first place, I hope you've noticed that I've been referring to Baker's What did the president know, quote, or question, I should say, occurring at roughly the same time, that is early to mid-July 1973, as Baker's secret meetings with Nixon and the White House staff about defending the president against Watergate accusations were going on? I emphasize this because all the evidence tells us that Baker asked, what did the president know and when did he know it, early in the whole Watergate investigation, and that he, that is Baker, was trying to establish that the president did not have prior knowledge of the Watergate burglary and the, frankly, ham-handed attempts to cover it up after the burglars were caught and it all became public. Baker was trying, essentially, to establish a chronological firewall around the president, which would prove that he was innocent of the wrongdoings of some of his misguided supporters. Baker was trying to build this firewall in July 1973 because he sincerely believed that the president was not guilty of the Watergate skullduggery, and, more importantly, that he believed Nixon when Nixon assured the country and Nixon assured Republican congressmen especially that he had no knowledge of it. This was the overwhelming attitude of the majority of Republicans in Congress for over a year, 73 and 74. At most, they believed, Nixon had some highly misguided zealots working for him, and they were going far beyond any purview that the committee to reelect the president may have given them. Again, for the most part, public opinion agreed with this sentiment during the spring and summer of 73. But later during the summer, as the guilt of the Watergate conspirators oozed out and up through the Nixon reelection committee and the White House staff, public opinion started to move away from the president. His approval ratings dropped significantly to around 40% by August 73. Things got worse as the summer ended. The sheer weight of testimony from those involved in the Watergate break-in and cover-up, especially Nixon's White House counsel John Dean, eroded the president's public support. Even by the end of September 73, though, support for Nixon among Republicans in Congress was solid. The Republicans on the Senate Watergate Committee and the House Judiciary Committee were highly skeptical of the idea that the president could sanction a break-in, much less a cover-up. In addition to believing Nixon when he told those Republicans personally that he was not guilty, they thought that no president would have been so stupid as to risk exposure of these crimes. There should, you know, at the very least have been many levels of buffers, to borrow a term from Godfather Part II, that kept the president from knowing or approving the Watergate break-in and cover-up. And the public was getting worn out by Watergate. Both houses of Congress were investigating it. It was on the news every single day. But it seemed that the drip, drip, drip of revelations about potential wrongdoing were just too small or too technical to require ousting an elected president. Some of you who may know the basics of Watergate chronology know that I'm getting close to the famous Saturday Night Massacre of October 20th, 1973. Nixon's secret recordings of White House meetings had become known May of 73, and the courts were trying to force him to hand over the tapes. Nixon refused. And the whole controversy over executive privilege versus the public's right to know raged throughout the summer. Now, Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, who had been appointed by Attorney General Elliot Richardson to head a Justice Department investigation of Watergate, pushed for a court order to have the tapes released. Nixon resisted in several ways. To make a long story short, again, it's probably worth another episode, as we would like to say in the show, the White House offered to release edited transcripts of the tapes, and Cox rejected this idea by the end of the summer. Nixon then ordered Cox to stop any legal proceedings to obtain the tapes and other White House internal communications. Okay, remember, during all this, even though he was investigating Watergate and the question of whether Nixon was involved, Cox actually worked for Nixon as part of the Justice Department. So then Cox announced that he would continue to press the courts to get tapes from the White House, even if it meant that Nixon would have to be held in contempt if he didn't turn them over. This was then a standoff between Nixon and his own Justice Department. Nixon ordered his Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, to fire Cox. Richardson refused and resigned. Nixon then ordered Assistant Attorney General William Ruckelshaus to do it. Ruckelshaus also refused and resigned. Finally, Nixon ordered Solicitor General Robert Burke to fire Cox, and he did so. You might think that this Saturday Night Massacre sounds so bad and was the final straw that broke the back of Republican political support for Nixon. You know, it certainly looked as if the White House was extremely paranoid and certainly corrupt. Well, yes and no. The Saturday Night Massacre was enough for the Democratic-controlled House Judiciary Committee to propose actually going ahead with impeachment resolutions. This led to a party-line vote to start the resolution process, and the vote was 21 to 17. All Republicans voted no. Throughout the winter of 73 and 74, however, Republican senators and representatives started to brace for what might be, at the very least, charges of obstruction against Nixon because he was on the verge of actually refusing court orders. These Republicans started to get somewhat suspicious, but for the most part, they consoled themselves that technically Nixon was solely protecting executive privilege. That is, broadly speaking, that private conversations about administrative policy had to remain secret for all sorts of reasons, including national security. And public opinion started to change, or at least started to solidify behind the idea of impeachment proceedings. In early November 73, several major newspapers called for Nixon to resign, and any remaining wavering Democrats in Congress were more or less becoming convinced that impeachment was the only way to get at the truth of Watergate and to decide what to do about it. And so, faced with this, Nixon went on television on November 17th to claim that the investigations must continue because he insisted he was not a crook. And so, on May 9th, 1974, formal impeachment hearings began. The Nixon White House released edited transcripts of the Watergate tapes in April and May, but the House Judiciary Committee determined that the edited transcripts weren't enough. Wrangling over the release of the tapes and other confidential material dominated the proceedings. Nixon's supporters stressed that a president could only be impeached if he had committed, quote, great offenses and was not just guilty of maladministration. But the hearings of the House Judiciary Committee just kept turning up more evidence of wrongdoing. Finally, they decided that Nixon's edited transcripts of the tapes didn't present the full picture of what had been going on inside the White House in 72 and early 73. They demanded the full tapes. But Nixon stalled and worked various legal maneuvers to keep the original tapes secret. Now, throughout all this, Republican committee members towed the party line. They cited executive privilege, argued that Nixon's staff was at fault, not him, and that nothing that the president did about Watergate rose to the level of an impeachable offense. The committee hearings, the partisan bickering, the ceaseless media coverage of the proceedings plagued the American political scene in June of 74. But a crucial element in the eventual bipartisan part of bringing forward articles of impeachment was gearing up behind the scenes, and things started to move very quickly. Led by Walter Flowers from Alabama, a small group of conservative, mostly Southern Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee agreed to meet with a group of moderate Republicans on the same committee, led by Thomas Railsback from Illinois, and to kind of discuss what to do about the mounting evidence. Now, they agreed to meet away from Congress, right? You see, support and opposition to impeachment was still divided mostly on partisan lines in Congress, but these particular representatives were becoming more and more troubled by the evidence that Nixon had been trying to use the FBI and the CIA, sometimes against each other, to cover up his involvement in Watergate. The Flowers-Railsback group from the Judiciary Committee met on July 23rd and hammered out a compromise that they thought would appeal to a sufficient number of Judiciary Committee members to recommend articles of impeachment to the full House of Representatives. What they did was agree to stress abuse of power and obstruction of justice. And then they went back to meet with their fellow party members to gauge the support for impeachment. Well, they didn't have to wait long. Republican Congressman Lawrence Hogan of Maryland had seen enough evidence of Nixon's offenses that he was ready to go public. And he was the first Republican member of the House to do so. On July 23rd, the same day that the Flowers-Railsback group at that informal meeting, Hogan made an announcement on television that he would vote for the impeachment of President Nixon. And here's the essential part of that statement.
I wish with all my heart that I could say to you now that the President of the United States is innocent of wrongdoing, that he has not committed an impeachable offense. But I cannot say that. After having read and reread and sifted and tested this mass of information which came before us, I've come to the conclusion that Richard M. Nixon has, beyond a reasonable doubt, committed impeachable offenses which, in my judgment, are of such sufficient magnitude that he should be removed from office. The evidence convinces me that my president has lied repeatedly, deceiving public officials and the American people. He has withheld information necessary for our system of justice to work. Instead of cooperating with prosecutors and investigators, as he said publicly, he concealed and covered up evidence and coached witnesses so that their testimony would show things that really were not true. He tried to use the CIA to impede the investigation of Watergate by the FBI. He approved the payment of what he knew to be blackmail to buy the silence of an important Watergate witness. He praised and rewarded those whom he knew had committed perjury. He personally helped to orchestrate a scenario of events, facts, and testimony to cover up wrongdoing in the Watergate scandal and to throw investigators and prosecutors off the track. He actively participated in an extended and extensive conspiracy to obstruct justice. To my mind, he is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of having committed these impeachable offenses.
Hogan was a conservative Republican, and it would seem that his coming out so strongly in favor of impeachment and removal would open the floodgates for other Republicans, including those in the Senate, to announce their support for impeachment. But it didn't. Republicans on the Judiciary Committee remained divided between those pushing for impeachment on abuse of power and obstruction of justice grounds and those who argued that the evidence was not yet strong enough. The informal Flowers-Railsback group I mentioned earlier had hammered out five proposed articles of impeachment to set before the Judiciary Committee. And they'd drafted those proposals in kind of moderate language, hoping to get as much bipartisan support as possible. Still, those impeachment articles were not unanimously supported by the committee. Three were approved. Article 1, obstruction of justice. Democrats voting yes, 21-0. Republicans, 6 yes, 11 no. Article 2, abuse of power. Democrats voting yes, 21-0. Republicans, 7 yes and 10 no. Article 3, contempt of Congress. Democrats voting 19 yes and 2 no. And Republicans, 2 yes and 15 no. Now, despite the fact that so many Republicans voted against these things, they passed the Judiciary Committee, and two of the other articles, Article 4, usurping the power of Congress about secret bombing in Cambodia, and Article 5, tax fraud, were rejected by the committee as a whole. After the Judiciary Committee approved the three articles of impeachment, the full House of Representatives started to get ready for a full vote on them. Since they were likely to pass them because of them, the Democratic majority there, the Senate also started to get ready for the eventual trial of President Nixon. Now, this was all happening during the last days of July and the first days of August 1974. Then came the famous smoking gun tape. On August 5th, 1973, Nixon handed over all his tapes as required by the courts. He lost that court battle. Among other things, they revealed a June 23rd, 1972 conversation between Nixon and H.R. Haldeman, who was his chief of staff at the time. And that conversation in a meeting was only a few days after the break-in and arrests at Watergate. In that conversation, Nixon and Haldeman discussed the break-in, discussed the arrests, and then went on to talk about what the White House would do about it. They more or less decided that the best way to cover it all up was to coerce the CIA into saying that an investigation of Watergate would be a danger to national security, and to try to convince the FBI that this was the case. Now, of course, we all call this the smoking gun tape because it showed that Nixon not only knew about the breakup, the break-in, and the cover-up, but planned the cover-up with Haldeman. And I hate to belabor the chronology thing, buzzkillers, but it's important here. The smoking gun meeting itself happened on June 23rd, 1972, a full 2 years before the House Judiciary Committee proposed its articles of impeachment. That meant that Nixon had been lying about Watergate not only to the public, but more pertinent to the questions raised in this episode, to his fellow Republicans. And it was then that the Republicans faded away. Senator Howard Baker, he of the famous What Did the President Know and When Did He Know It statement of 1973, came out in support of impeachment, as did many other Republican senators and congressmen who had been strong Nixon supporters. Words they used to announce their reaction to the smoking gun tape included devastating, impeachable. They talked about themselves being dumbfounded and having, quote, a terrible letdown feeling. Edward Hutchison, the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, sort of summed it up for these Republicans who felt betrayed by Nixon when he said that he would vote for impeachment with a heavy heart. This was all happening August 5th and 6th, 1974. At roughly the same time, Vice President Gerald Ford told Nixon that he would no longer defend him over impeachment. He'd remain loyal to Nixon's policies, but he wouldn't answer public questions about impeachment anymore. He's basically saying, you're on your own when it comes to impeachment. Now, remember, Ford had been a major congressman before he was appointed vice president, so he'd been a major Republican for a long time. I want to stress that it was the overwhelming mass of evidence against Nixon, the now obvious fact that he'd been in on the planning of the cover-up from the very beginning, and perhaps most of all, the fact that their own president had been lying to them directly, in some cases face-to-face, about his involvement in Watergate, that forced the majority of Republicans to support impeachment and removal eventually. The majority of Republicans, that is, but not all. Senator Carl Curtis from Nebraska worried that if Nixon resigned or was thrown out of office, the United States would go down the road of a banana republic with constant turnover between warring political parties grasping against each other over every little thing. And perhaps the strongest rejection of the smoking gun evidence came from Earl Landgraf, Republican representative from Indiana, who said, quote, "Don't confuse me with the facts. I've got a closed mind. I will not vote for impeachment. I'm going to stick with my president, even if he and I have to be taken out of this building and shot." Still, on August 7th, Senator Barry Goldwater and a couple of Republican representatives met with Nixon to tell him that he would certainly be impeached and that he no longer had enough votes in the Senate to avoid being convicted and removed from office. The next day, August 8th, Nixon told Gerald Ford, told the cabinet, and told congressional leaders that he would resign. And his televised resignation speech to the nation aired that night. We all had to watch it. The Duke and Duchess brought us in and sat us down and make it watch it, like all kids of my generation. Nixon's resignation became official at 11:35 a.m. the next day after he left the White House and returned to California. So what can the behavior of the Republicans during the Nixon impeachment crisis tell us about current Republicans and the Trump impeachment crisis? In addition to the usual caveats about no two historical events being the same or even developing in similar ways, we should keep the following in mind. Watergate was different because the Democrats controlled both the Senate and the House of Representatives. That's one of the reasons why both houses of Congress could start investigations into Watergate and call witnesses right away. Now, even though impeachment articles have to come from the House of Representatives in accordance with the Constitution, in Nixon's case, it was the Senate investigations that provided the most damaging testimony, especially from former Nixon aides like John Dean. But both houses of Congress were going at it simultaneously, and the news was dominated by it. Watergate was also different because the evidence of the crime and Nixon's complicity in it only became clear after 2 years of investigation, 1972 to 1974. And ultimately, the revelations in the smoking gun tape coming out in the beginning of August 1974 were devastating. Remember the chronology. The House Judiciary Committee approved articles of impeachment on July 30th, 1974. The smoking gun tape appeared on August 5th. And Nixon had resigned and was on the plane back to California the morning of August 9th. That's only an 11-day span, Brothers Killers. Sure, 2 years of investigation led up to those 11 days, but Republicans, by and large, to a great degree, stayed loyal to Nixon until the very end. Senators Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski, during the Trump impeachment, might be filling the role that Senator Edward Burke played in 1973 when he was the first Republican to suspect Nixon of wrongdoing and suggest impeachment. And a handful of other senators now seem to be silent about removing Trump, at least until they see more evidence during a Senate trial. But there are also a great many senators like Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, and representatives like Jim Jordan and Louis Gohmert and Matt Gaetz, who seem to be echoing the Nixon-supporting Earl Landgraf in 1974, who said he'd be willing to be taken out and shot along with his president before voting, rather than vote for impeachment. But that's where the parallels end, and they're fairly tenuous parallels at that. We'll have to see what happens, as President Trump says so often. Maybe there's another smoking gun. Maybe there are other crimes. Only a full trial has a chance of letting us know. So what do I think about the story of, quote, the Republicans who pushed Nixon out being the real heroes of Watergate, end quote? Well, yes. Most Republicans eventually realized that President Nixon had committed crimes and attempted to obstruct justice. But we have a tendency to compress and condense time and causation when we make easy historical judgments like this. It took a very long time and a ton of evidence for people like Howard Baker and Barry Goldwater to reach their conclusions. After the smoking gun tape was revealed and analyzed, abandoning Nixon became a slam dunk. But at least most Republicans did it. And all the historical evidence points to the fact that those Republicans who turned on Nixon eventually did not do so because public opinion had become strongly pro-impeachment by mid-1974. They did so because the facts proved Nixon's guilt overwhelmingly. But also, by August 1974, they were not afraid of their political base of support back in their constituencies. In fact, a good many of Republican House members faced primary challenges in 74 and 76, those elections, and lost, partly because they turned on Nixon. So these impeachment Republicans didn't bow to public opinion on either side, the strongly pro-Nixon anti-impeachment side, and the increasingly pro-impeachment side of general public opinion through 74, if you get what I mean. There's absolutely no evidence that any of these Republican senators or representatives quaked in their boots over what public opinion would think about them. And all the evidence that we have points overwhelmingly to the fact that they voted their conscience when it came time to do so. Most importantly, however, buzzkillers, you know that I rebel against the ahistorical tendency to find a handful of heroes or an individual hero in any historical situation or victory. I've tried to show that in this episode in the same way that I complained about the Washington Post's Woodward and Bernstein being held up practically as saviors of the Republic during the Watergate scandal in one of our prior episodes. Lots of people were heroic in bringing about the best resolution of the Watergate scandal, and the vast majority of them are almost completely forgotten by most of us. Lots of different news outlets, federal agencies, congressional committees were responsible for breaking elements of the Watergate story and bringing the evidence to light. These include the local Washington, D.C. police, the FBI, the Justice Department, special prosecutors, dozens and dozens of investigators in the House of Representatives and the Senate, the Supreme Court, and other federal judges. Complicated things require complex and sophisticated analyses. Something as serious and widespread as the Watergate scandal required hundreds of heroes. And in the same way, I've relied on the work of dozens of historians and journalists for the material presented in this episode. You'll find many of them listed at the end of the blog post about this episode, as well as on the Buzzkill bookshelf. So please be sure to go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com, click on the Patreon button to support the show, and do all the other things you do with the website. Talk to you next week.